Good evening. This is the Voice of America in Washington. Welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'm Douglas Impuga. And this evening we'll talk about the growing income inequality in Africa. And with me here in studio is my colleague, Patrick Dare. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me back.
You're welcome. And also joining us by phone from D.C. is Dr. Nick Galasso. Nick is a senior researcher at Oxfam America. Nick, welcome back. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Douglas, for having me. It's very nice to be with you.
Thank you very much. You're welcome. And as I said, our topic tonight is going to be income inequality. Africa accounts for a large share of the world's people living in absolute poverty. Its share of the world poor rose has been rising. But growth has not entirely eluded Africa. In the 2000s, six of the world's 10 fastest growth countries were in Africa, but this has not significantly helped to equal incomes or to redistribute wealth. So let's start from that point, Dr. Galasso. How seriously should we take the issue of income inequality, especially in a continent like Africa?
I think that it's a dire issue, and it's an issue that we have to take very seriously if our objective is to eliminate extreme poverty. You know, it's been shown for many decades now that there's a strong link between high extreme inequality and progress in terms of reducing global poverty. You know, and just as you said, Douglas, the sub-Saharan African continent has seen some of the fastest growing economies in the last decades, but that growth hasn't translated into reducing poverty in ways that we like to see. So I think that if we care about eradicating extreme poverty, we have to take extreme inequality seriously. And if I could just give you a quick example of the importance that the income distribution within a country has on the life chances of a country's people. You know, if you compare Bangladesh and Nigeria, they have about the same average incomes. Nigeria is only slightly richer, but it's far less equal. And the result is that a child who is born in Nigeria is three times more likely to die before their fifth birthday than a child born in Bangladesh.
Wow, that's a serious thing. Now, Patrick, when we talk about these figures and inequality, these are not things that abstract. You go to African countries, you can actually tell that there's growth inequality among the people.
Oh, yeah. It's very, very obvious. You go to any part of any of the African countries, and in this case, I'll talk about Kenya. It is so obvious, it's unbelievable. You go to a city like Nairobi, and you see the wealth and the flamboyance of those people that have the money. Mm-hmm. And then you, not within Nairobi itself, you go to a place like Kibera and mm-hmm. and you see dire poverty. The difference is years apart. Mm-hmm. And you wonder, sometimes you wonder, they tell you that, oh, this country's GDP grew by a certain amount of percentage. And you wonder, what are they talking about? Mm-hmm. When, you know, people don't feel it, you know, mm-hmm. people are starving in some mm-hmm. places.
I see. Nick, I was reading a report by the African Development Bank, and it says Africa is also the world's second most inequitable region after Latin America. Is that this? Has this got to do with Africa starting off as having a number of people so poor, or what do you think accounts for that?
Yeah, it's a really good question, you know, and I think that when we talk about the causes or the sources of inequality in Africa, you know, we could have the whole show just focus on that, right? Mm. I think that first and foremost, you know, you have to address and think about the context, particularly the legacy of colonialism, and particularly how political systems in Africa, in many instances, really just replaced the colonial overlords that were there, right? So they kind of replaced these structures. But I think in more proximate terms, we have to think about, you know, how unfair tax systems are across African countries. We see that poor people tend to pay more in taxes than the rich. And the amount of revenues that are foregone because of generous tax incentives to big corporations, which places more burdens on the poor. Related, we can talk about, you know, the extent of illicit financial flows that are just flying out of the continent as well. I just saw one statistic that said that about nearly 6% of the combined GDP of sub-Saharan Africa, that equivalent is lost in financial flows. As Patrick said, in terms, you know, looking at Kenya, for example, I think Kenya is a good case to look at the types of unfair distribution of investment that sometimes breaks down to identity politics. So you have networks of patronage that, you know, when certain groups become in power, they benefit their people as opposed to others, which leads to, you know, unfair access to services and the like. We can talk about conflict in the continent, but also I think the deficit of good governance that we see, and the lack of really equal political representation, the lack of transparency, the exclusion of poor people from the decision-making process, gender injustices, all of these, I think, combine to really create this edifice of inequality across the continent.
Yeah, he mentioned there the issue of the structures, political structures, and the legacy of colonialism. I think that's a very pertinent issue, because take a country like Kenya. What's happening in Kenya is almost similar to what's happening in South Africa, because when the British left Kenya, the African elite took over and amassed wealth. South Africa, after apartheid, they also, those Africans became like white, and they took over the wealth, and now there's that class of very wealthy Africans with the majority remaining poor.
And the point that the good doctor is actually mentioned is that the fact that the few that are within that political circle, the wealth that is there revolves around that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, I'm of this opinion that, yes, political power, you know, gives a certain group of people that, you know, in power some leverage. Mm-hmm. But when you take a typical, for example, I'll give Kenya because that's where I come from and that's what I'm familiar with. If you take a typical person from Kiambu and take a typical person from Ugenya or in Elgeyo Marakwet, they're no different in terms of their earning power, in terms of you know, being accessible to the wealth. I think the common factor is because there is very little productivity in terms of industry that would provide employment. Things like you know, health is a big issue, because when people are not healthy and there's no health services, they're not productive. And so you find that people that can afford it, ministers of health, leave the country to go and be treated elsewhere. What have the rest of the people got to do when they're suffering from the same kind of illness? Mm-hmm. And yet their mandate, the people that are elected under the top officials, are mandated to provide these services. So I think it's a combination of a lot of things. Big part of it is the wealth, you know, being dominated by people, the so-called people in the circle and the political political circles.
Nick, you mentioned several issues there, and most of them rotate around issues of governance, because if there's less corruption, if there are fair taxation, good governance, maybe this issue of economic inequality would be addressed. Now, organizations like yours work with some of these governments. Are the governments or the people in power in those countries aware of this crisis?
I think so. I think, as Patrick indicated, you know, you can't go to, you know, a place like Kenya and see the grave inequality between places like Nairobi and then other more rural places. So I think that leaders are aware of the grave inequality, but I think that in a lot of ways it boils down to a question of political will. And political opportunity to do something about it. You know, just as you said earlier, you know, 6 of the 10 most unequal countries are in sub-Saharan Africa, and I think that in a lot of ways, when we look at the leadership, we have to look at who is actually operating at the top of the political spectrum, who has taken over from for example, from the colonial elites, right? You know, the two richest South Africans own the same amount of wealth as the bottom half of the country. So I think that it's still important to look at how the distribution of power really plays a part here. But I think that you're right. I think that it's also about looking at the structure of the economy. We see incredible dependence upon just a few commodities. That makes Africa, of course, you know, that draws on Africa's natural resources, but hinders widespread investment in diversifying the economy. That I think would be quite, you know, which would be quite helpful to pulling more people out.
He mentioned their natural resources. Some people have observed that in those resource-rich countries in Africa, that's why even inequality is even worse, because the few elite steal everything, loot everything. You can talk of Angola, you can talk... Nigeria, for instance, has oil, but many millionaires in dollar terms and many millions in poverty. It hasn't helped. The resources haven't helped the people.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of the issue, I think there's a couple issues going on there. One, you know, extractive industries tend not to employ that many people, right? So it's a small percentage of the population that actually receive economic benefits. But then I think a lot of it also plays into the fact that I was talking about earlier in terms of illicit financial flows that are leaving the continent. So that, you know, that the proper, the appropriate revenues are not being reinvested or captured by the government and then expended on pro-poor investment in terms of infrastructure, in terms of health, as you said earlier, in terms of diversifying the economy.
I think another thing that just plays a part in this is also the lack of refining the raw material, the raw resources. When you look at oil or any other, the diamonds and whatnot, the multinational companies kind of have a dominance in that. They come in. And these countries lack the capacity to, and I don't know whether it's just lack of capacity or lack of the will to actually do it. Most of the raw resources are exported outside, mm-hmm. and then imported back in as refined, you know, for consumption, which in itself leaves a very big gap in terms of employment because, yes, you extract these things, you extract the raw material. But then you don't have an industry that will refine it so that you can earn the big dollar from it and actually bring back or have the big dollars within the country itself. And when you look at things like agriculture, the same practice mm-hmm. has been, you know, been done for the last 30, 40 years. Yet we know that there's been technology advancements in agriculture, for instance, which is a big part of the you know, the local person's wealth building blocks.
Yeah, but the trouble is, some people have pointed out, is even in, you mentioned agricultural products, think crops like coffee, cotton,
right?
Where the peasant, the farmers who grow these crops, okay, don't benefit because it's the middleman, the elite, who buy it from them and export the products, who benefit. They buy the coffee beans, sell them, and make more money. The person who grows them ends with peanuts.
But that's why there has to be a concerted effort to have these things, these products, actually refined within the country itself. You know, when you buy a bar of chocolate, it's so expensive. Mm. And yet, where does the chocolate come from? Mostly from West African countries. And you'll find that those farmers themselves, I think I read a story somewhere where somebody was testing refined, you know, finished product chocolate for the first time. Mm. And he had been farming this for a long, long time. I think there has to be a leap from our government, from just consumption, because we are more of consumers of finished products other than producers of them. And when you produce, then you provide more employment, a bigger base for employment. Other things come into play, new skills, new thoughts of doing things. And I think that's the only way, maybe long-term, this inequality would be at least narrowed.
But Nick, with most economies on the African continent, isn't it in the interest of the wealthy to keep the poor poorer so they can thrive on their whatever misfortune?
I mean, I think it's a hard question to answer. I think Patrick's analysis is totally right. I think that we see, you know, what he's describing about, you know, being raw producers, but cutting out the middle, the finished goods piece of it, and then becoming sort of a consumer-based economy, certainly harkens back to the dependency theories of the 1970s, right? And I think that increasing the diversification, leading to new skills, new types of jobs that bringing on more finished types of industries could bring, I think, is a great solution. It's hard to answer your question directly, Douglas, but if you look at a place like Angola, for example, which is essentially a kleptocracy. I mean, you know, the people exist in one way to enrich the leadership. And I think that that's a clear case where, you know, you have really a predator type of government that's feeding off of poor people and keeping them in vulnerable positions.
I think that is, you know, it is a hard question, but you see the evidence of it.
Yes.
Just look at the elected leaders anywhere in Africa, sub-Saharan countries. They've not grasped the theory of teach our people how to fish. They want to give piecemeal. During campaigns, they come and give people, you know, salt, sugar, mm-hmm. whatnot. They disappear. There's no plan at all on how to, you know, for the boat to lift everybody up. So
yeah, the trouble,
it is in their best interest that people do not, you know, get to that point where they can question what they're doing.
And in that sense, even share on the wealth.
Exactly, because then, you know, if people become, more aware through education and whatnot, they start questioning things. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if you keep them poor, because when you look at even the cost of universities now, the cost of education, a lot of kids cannot, you know, parents cannot afford for the kids to go to school because of the expense or the high fees.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, in the long term, you're actually stifling the ability for people to think, and therefore the ability for people to question what you're doing.
Well, gentlemen, hold your thought. Gentlemen, let's take a short break. We'll be back again to continue our discussion of the growing income inequality in Africa.
African Music Mix.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
Welcome back. In case you're just tuning in, you're listening to Reporters Roundtable, and we're coming to you live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. Our topic tonight is the growing income inequality in Africa, and our panelists are Patrick Deer, my colleague here, and Dr. Nick Galasso, a senior researcher at Oxfam America, and I'm your host, Douglas Impoga, here in Studio 9. Let me go back to Nick. There are those who argue that the structural adjustment programs of the World Bank and IMF in the 80s contributed to this inequality in a very significant way. What's your take on that?
I mean, that's absolutely the case. I mean, it was an economic, it was a theory, it was an idea, essentially, of the types of structural reforms countries needed to make to their economies that would spur really growth. And it's based on the assumption that growth is the primary engine of eradicating poverty. But as we have seen, you know, yes, growth is important to eradicating poverty, but how growth is distributed among a population is actually more important. And I think, actually, Douglas, this gets back to your question that you were raising earlier about, you know, who benefits in African countries, right? Or at least who has benefited from the growth in the last couple decades. You know, if we look at how the top 5%, for example, in places like Nigeria or Ghana or Kenya, for instance, you know, how have they done compared to the poorest 40%? We have seen that as GDP growth has increased, most of those gains have actually accrued very much to the top. And a lot of this is spurred because of the types of structural adjustment programs that were mandated by the World Bank and the IMF.
Patrick, another interesting factor is the IMF and the World Bank, they have come out to say those programs were flawed and they stopped popularizing them. But it's interesting and ironical that some countries, some governments, most governments in Africa still are intent on keeping them in place.
Because they benefit from them. I mean, it's easy money, which they don't pay directly. And therefore, and when you look, you know, the amazing thing about the, one other thing I think about, the financial structures of our countries. Mm. It boggles the mind to think that, for example, take the CDF money, which was an initiative that was brought into Kenya to try and redistribute the wealth into the constituencies. Suddenly, you have a member of parliament controlling a certain amount of money, and it's almost like it's pocket change. They're the signatories, so you don't find very strong financial structures that have control such that the money is not pilfered. So the top people have the access to this money, and since they're not paying it back, they don't have the will or the obligation to do the right thing with them.
So you see, most of the programs, I mean, some of the programs that were which were imposed, now they affected. We talked about education,
right?
Now the education has become expensive. Hospitals, healthcare has crumbled, and people can't afford these things. So, Nick, how long do you think this can be sustainable without the situation exploding beyond what it is now?
I mean, we know that. Just to add to that, I mean, when we think about structural adjustment programs, it's certainly also the explosion, the push towards greater privatization of public services. So you talked about education, but we could also talk about the provision of water and sanitation and how, for example, in South Africa, this has led to some people talking about a water apartheid between those that can afford and those that can't afford, which drives inequality even higher. And to get to your point, what we know about highly unequal societies versus more equal societies is that there's greater social discontent, social dislocation, alienation, conflict. I mean, you know, living in a highly unequal society is not a very happy place, right? So I think it's hard to say, you know, to project, are we reaching a tipping point? I hope that we are, at least through the data that we have that's demonstrated how much inequality has become worse, you know, not only in Africa, but even in rich countries. I was actually at an OECD meeting this morning where they were presenting some findings, and they basically said that in the last 20, 30 years, inequality has become worse in good times economically and bad times. So I think that people are starting to wake up and demand that their leaders really start to address these changes.
And now I'll put this on to both of you because he mentions with this kind of inequality, stability becomes, I mean, there's bound to be instability. People rise up and there's conflict and all that. But then how possible is it to have this kind of inequality and have democratic governance in those countries?
Democracy in those countries is, I don't know whether it's very accurate to the term of democracy. And that could probably be another topic altogether. But I think when this can only come to an end if, first and foremost, the people themselves take charge and know who they're electing and demand for, you know, for those services.
But that assumes there's a level of good governance for them to be able to demand and be heard.
Exactly. But, you know, it is, I think it, The more people move towards somehow a semblance of, for example, if we, and I keep reference to Kenya, when you now see the Kenya constitution change to where some powers have been taken away from the president, parliament has more power. The counties now have finances allocated to them. So the power grid is getting lower to the people. People can demand certain things from their county government. Mm. And if the county government have, hopefully, which I up to now I don't think has happened, if they have a better agenda, they can demand more from the government. So this tier of demand for better services, maybe, and for better structures, probably would move towards that.
Let me put it to him. Can a society that is unequal economically be democratic?
I'm sorry, Douglas. Can you say it one more time?
I was asking whether it's possible to have a society that is unequal economically and then be democratic at the same time.
I think that, you know, to be quite clear for where I stand, extreme economic inequality is not an outcome of economics. It's an outcome of unequal power relationships, which I think diminishes the idea of equal representation or democracy. I think that when we see countries with extreme inequality, we're seeing countries that have extreme democratic deficits. And I would even apply the same analogy to the United States, where, you know, the wealthy and the elites dominate the type of political outcomes that we see here. And in many ways, that has driven U.S. inequality. So I think that they don't go hand in hand, mm-hmm. extreme inequality and democracy.
Last word, Patrick. How do you say things? Because according to the published reports, things are not getting better. They're getting worse. Do you see an improvement in the near future, the last 10 seconds?
One can only hope and be optimistic. In the near future, I don't think so. There's going to have to be some very drastic structural changes, and hopefully some leaders who have the willpower to not just think about themselves, but who really are driven by what legacy they want to leave behind. When you look at the great countries and people who gave the great countries a foundation, they had a future in mind. They did not govern from the present. Until that happens, it's going to be difficult.
Last word, where do we see the continent headed? Because the things that don't seem to be improving.
I'm optimistic. I think in the near future that the continent has significant issues. Oxfam has raised the inequality issue quite prominently at the World Economic Forum in Davos every year. We're going to be raising it in 2 weeks in Cape Town at the World Economic Forum that's happening there. Our executive director will be there. You know, and we're pushing for serious global corporate tax changes and other types of ways to really change the rigged rules that allow elites and have allowed really the richest to do great, while the poor and the middle classes are stagnating across not only across the continent but across most countries in the world.
And Oxfam has hope that those recommendations will be adopted.
I mean, we're going to keep pushing, right? And we're going to keep organizing with our constituents and working with citizens and poor people around the world to really make these demands heard.
I see. Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'd like to thank our panel, my colleague Patrick Deyer and Dr. Nick Galasso. Nick is a senior researcher at Oxfam America. Gentlemen, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Our producer was Jackson Mvunganyi, and our engineer tonight was Andreas Regis. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Reporters Roundtable. A reminder that in case you missed any part of this program, you can still listen to it by going to our main website at www.voanews.com. Click on Programs and scroll down to Reporters Roundtable. Once again, thanks very much for tuning in. And until next week, I'm your host, Douglas Impoga, here in Washington. Have a good evening.